Today is Thursday, May 22nd, and this is the World Socialist Website. Rise of the far right in Europe, a product of the anti-working class and pro-war policies of the established parties, by Johannes Stern. The results of the latest elections across Europe underscore a dangerous and accelerating trend, the rise of far-right and fascistic forces and their growing integration into the heart of official politics. In Portugal, the neo-fascist Chega party surged to over 22% of the vote, securing 58 seats in parliament. In Poland, the first round of presidential elections saw three far-right candidates, Karol Nowacki, PIS, Sławomir Mentzen, Konfederacja, and Grzegorz Braun, collectively win over 50% of the vote. In Romania, George Simion, the candidate of the Fascist Alliance for the Union of Romanians, or AUR, received 46% in the second-round presidential vote. These developments mark a menacing historic shift. In Portugal, the far right has gained a decisive foothold in national politics for the first time since the fall of the fascist Estado Novo regime in 1974. In Poland and Romania, countries where democracy was supposedly established after the Stalinist dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, fascistic and ultranationalist forces now dominate political life. This phenomenon is not the product of a mass revival of fascist ideology from below, but the result of a deliberate shift to the right by the entire political establishment, which has spearheaded relentless attacks on the social conditions and democratic rights of the working class. Confronting rising opposition from below, the ruling class is increasingly resorting to authoritarian and fascistic methods to defend the power of a tiny capitalist oligarchy, implementing genocidal policies, and preparing for world war. The media and political elites consciously normalize far-right forces, give them platforms, adapt their rhetoric, and bring them into government, most prominently in the U.S. with Trump, in Argentina with Milei, and in Italy with Meloni. Above all, responsibility lies with the so-called left parties and trade unions, which have paved the way for the far-right. The parties of the pseudo-left have played an instrumental role in politically disarming the working class. In Portugal, the path to Chega's rise has been paved by the political betrayals of the Socialist Party and its left cover, the Left Bloc. During the previous PS-led governments, the Left Bloc supported austerity budgets and helped implement social cuts dictated by the European Union. Rather than mobilizing the working class against these measures, the Left Bloc channeled opposition back into the capitalist state. This mirrored the disastrous experience of Greece, where the pseudo-left Syriza government not only imposed the diktats of the EU and IMF, destroying wages, pensions, and public services, but did so in coalition with the far-right independent Greeks. The same patterns are being repeated across the continent. In France, Emmanuel Macron has relied on the betrayals of Jean-Luc Mélenchon's France Insoumise in his new Popular Front alliance with the Socialist Party and French Communist Party to carry out a brutal austerity agenda, anti-immigrant laws, and police repression. The refusal of France Insoumise to mobilize the working class, above all during the mass strikes against pension reform in 2023, paved the way for the rise of Marine Le Pen's far right. When Macron's government teetered on collapse, the New Popular Front, or NFP, propped it up by backing his Renaissance Party against Le Pen's national rally. This allowed Macron to continue dictating policy, while the NFP came first in the general election, but on a reduced majority, handing Le Pen the ability to posture as the only real opposition to the establishment. In Germany, the rise of the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, is a direct product of the total complicity of the mainstream parties. The new government, led by right-wing ex-banker Friedrich Merz of the Christian Democratic Union, or CDU, is overseeing the most extensive remilitarization of Germany since the fall of Hitler's Third Reich, with massive military spending increases and an aggressive war drive against Russia. Merz's coalition includes the Social Democrats and is backed by both the Greens and the Left Party. Far from opposing militarism and austerity, these parties have become their chief enforcers. Their abandonment of any pretense of social reform and their embrace of imperialist war have created the political vacuum now occupied by the AfD. So extreme is the established party's warmongering that even the thoroughly militarist AfD can posture as an anti-war party, criticizing NATO's aggression against Russia from the standpoint of German national economic and energy interests. In Britain, Labour Party leader and Prime Minister Keir Starmer heads a government that embraces Thatcherite austerity, echoes the xenophobia of Nigel Farage, champions military spending, and threatens imperialist war with Russia. Starmer was handed the leadership by former leader Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour left, who, despite the support of millions of workers and youth, including 500,000 new members, refused to drive out the right wing, promoted by Britain's pseudo-left groups as transforming Labour into a genuine workers' party. They instead have served to strengthen its right-wing and pro-imperialist policies. Crucial and urgent lessons must be drawn. The fight against the far right cannot be waged through alliances with any faction of the bourgeois political establishment. The official left parties have shown themselves to be ruthless enemies of the working class. Pseudo-left in Stalinist formations, such as Syriza in Greece, the Left Bloc in Portugal, Die Linke in Germany, France Insoumise, and the Corbynite milieu in Britain have functioned to subordinate the working class to the trade union bureaucracy and the capitalist state. These betrayals are not accidental, but rather the reflection of the privileged middle-class social layer these parties represent, whose material interests are tied to the preservation of the capitalist profit system. What is urgently necessary is the building of the International Committee of the Fourth International, the world Trotskyist movement in every country. Only the ICFI fights to unify the international working class in a common struggle against social inequality, war, dictatorship, and the capitalist profit system. Only through the development of a socialist and internationalist movement can a relapse into fascism and war be prevented, and a real future for humanity be secured. For the first time, Netanyahu names ethnic cleansing of Gaza as an official war aim, by Andre Damon. On Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time officially stated that an Israeli war aim is the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, openly stating what had been the unspoken goal of Israel since October 7, 2023. In a news conference, Netanyahu said that Israel, quote, is ready to end the war under clear conditions that will ensure the safety of Israel. All the hostages come home, Hamas lays down its arms, steps down from power, its leadership is exiled from the strip. Gaza is totally disarmed, and we carry out the Trump plan, a plan that is so correct and revolutionary, end quote. The Times of Israel commented that, quote, this represents the first time the U.S. president's plan for moving Gaza civilians out of the strip has been presented as an Israeli demand for ending the war. In February, U.S. President Trump declared that, quote, the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, we'll own it, unquote. He said the U.S. will, quote, level it out, unquote, and create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs, unquote. Trump explicitly called for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, stating that other countries will, quote, build various domains that will ultimately be occupied by the 1.8 million Palestinians living in Gaza. Netanyahu's declaration stands as an exposure of the Biden administration, which falsely claimed that it was seeking to create the conditions for a two-state solution, even as it funded, armed, and defended the Israeli genocide. In reality, the total occupation and ethnic cleansing of Gaza was always the aim of the Netanyahu government, which used the events of October 7th as a pretext to carry out this plan. Netanyahu's statement marks a public confirmation that Operation Gideon's Chariots, announced by Netanyahu earlier this month, but launched at full scale following Trump's trip to the Middle East last week, will be the means by which Israel seeks to carry out the forcible displacement of the Palestinian people in Gaza from their homeland. It confirms, moreover, that a central aim of Trump's trip to the Middle East was creating the diplomatic preconditions for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Trump was warmly embraced by the governments of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE, with the Qatari government giving Trump the gift of a $400 million jumbo jet to serve as his private plane while he was scheming the mass killing and dispossession of the Palestinian people. Last Friday, as Trump was leaving the region, NBC News reported that the White House has actively been negotiating with governments throughout the region to accept the displaced Palestinian people. The leading candidates which have emerged are Libya and Syria, two states whose governments were overthrown by U.S.-backed Islamist insurgencies. Even as Netanyahu openly adopts the ethnic cleansing of Palestine as an official war aim, his cabinet members are even more blunt, going right up to the verge of using the term ethnic cleansing as a positive good. On Monday, Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said that Israel's goal is, quote, destroying everything that's left of the Gaza Strip. He declared, quote, we are conquering, cleansing, and remaining in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed. Knowing it has the full support of the Trump administration, the Israeli government is going to previously unheard-of lengths of criminality. On Wednesday, the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, opened fire on a group of diplomats from over 20 countries, including the UK, France, and Canada, as they were visiting a refugee camp in the West Bank city of Jenin. Video footage of the tour shows Israeli troops consistently and repeatedly firing at least 7 shots at the delegation as they fled. In a statement, the IDF admitted that they fired at the delegation, calling the attack warning shots after it claimed the delegation deviated from an approved course. Despite Israeli claims that it has led a small number of trucks through to Gaza after a total 11-week-long blockade of food, fuel, and energy, the entire population of Gaza remains on the brink of famine. In a statement Wednesday, the head of the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, warned that the amount of food that has been allowed in is tiny compared to the amount necessary to prevent starvation. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said in a post on X, quote, children in Gaza continue to be killed, injured, and deprived of aid. The few trucks that have entered with life-saving supplies are nowhere near sufficient and have yet to reach those in desperate need. We're running out of supplies inside Gaza, and we're running out of time, unquote. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said, quote, the limited supplies finally being allowed to enter Karim Abu Salem border crossing are nowhere near enough to meet the needs in Gaza, which are vast, which are tremendous. Much, much more aid needs to get in, unquote. On Wednesday, Israeli attacks killed 82 people in Gaza, bringing the official death toll to 53,655, with 121,950 wounded, Gaza's health ministry said. The number of people killed since March 18th, when Israel unilaterally broke a 2-month ceasefire, has risen to over 3,500. On Tuesday, CNN reported that Israel is making active preparations for an attack on Iran's nuclear program, moving aircraft into position and carrying out training attacks. In a report Wednesday, Axios confirmed CNN's reporting, citing Israeli intelligence sources, with Axios reporting that, quote, Israel Defense Forces have been conducting exercises and other preparations for a possible strike in Iran, unquote. One source told Axios, quote, there is a lot of training, and the U.S. military sees everything and understands Israel is preparing, unquote. Another added, quote, Bibi is waiting for the nuclear talks to collapse, and for the moment, Trump will be disappointed about the negotiations and open to giving him a go-ahead, unquote. Jacobin and Labor Notes promote UAW election as a model for union democracy despite massive voter suppression, by Eric London. On May 17th, Jacobin magazine reposted an article from Labor Notes titled, UFCW Members Didn't Get to Pick Their New President. The article, written by Lisa Hsu, addresses the anti-democratic manner in which the United Food and Commercial Workers' new president, Milton Jones, was selected by the executive board behind the backs of 1.3 million rank-and-file members. The article begins by noting that outgoing President Mark Perrone announced his retirement earlier this month and that, quote, the same day, the union announced his successor, chosen in a special meeting of the International Executive Board, unquote. Though, quote, international presidents are supposed to be elected by delegates to the union's convention, unquote, the article explains, Jones is the fourth president in a row who has been chosen between conventions by the International Executive Board. The Executive Board consists of 55 leading bureaucrats, at least 36 of whom have salaries over $200,000 a year, paid by workers' dues money. The Jacobin Labor Notes article stops short of criticizing incoming President Milton Jones, instead noting that he, quote, is the union's first African-American president, and describing him as, quote, a UFCW member for 45 years, who started as a teenage courtesy clerk at a Kroger grocery store in Alabama, unquote. Be that as it may, Jones left the shop floor long ago and ascended the ranks of the union's massive bureaucracy. In 1990, he joined UFCW staff, winning promotion to a series of well-paid positions, including international representative, executive assistant to the director of Region 2, executive assistant to the international bargaining director, director of Region 5, international vice president, national bargaining director, executive vice president, and international secretary treasurer. According to public data from the Labor Department, he has been paid $4.6 million in workers' dues money since 2000 alone. In the past 5 years, he has taken home between $243,000 and $272,000 per year. Unlike most rank-and-file UFCW members, Jones is now due for another big pay raise. Outgoing President Perrone made $335,000 in 2024 and hasn't had a salary under $275,000 a year since 2007. Perrone has accumulated a staggering $6.2 million in less than 20 years in the UFCW bureaucracy. It would take a grocery store employee with a $40,000 a year salary a full 155 years to make as much money as Perrone. Lisa Hsu's article makes no reference to these figures and instead promotes another figure from the bureaucracy, Todd Crosby, as the Democratic alternative. Hsu writes that Crosby, quote, called for the UFCW to invest more in organizing and, quote, put rank-and-file members on bargaining teams, unquote. Crosby currently occupies the post of assistant to the president and netted $178,000 in 2024. Crosby has made close to $3 million since joining the UFCW apparatus in 2002. Jacobin and Labor Notes speak not as opponents of the bureaucracy and representatives of the rank and file. They represent a faction of the bureaucracy who are concerned that the nakedly anti-democratic character of leadership selection may produce a rank-and-file rebellion that threatens the bureaucracy's massive accumulation of wealth. This is shown most nakedly by the article's juxtaposition of the undemocratic union election process in the UFCW and the exemplary model of the UAW. Hsu, a former local staffer for UAW Local 5118, writes that, quote, reformers from the United Auto Workers met with the reform faction of the UFCW to discuss how, quote, one member, one vote had helped push the UAW in a more fighting direction. This, Hsu writes, is an example of union democracy. Hsu does not mention that the UAW bureaucracy did not decide to hold elections as an act of democratic good faith. It was forced to hold elections by a federal judge because of rampant corruption within the apparatus, which saw several past presidents convicted to jail terms. In the election the UAW ultimately held in 2022 was not a shining example of union democracy. It was conducted as an internal campaign within competing factions of the bureaucracy and involved massive voter suppression. In fact, each statement Labor Notes Jacobin's article makes to attack the UFCW's anti-democratic self-selection process for determining leadership applies equally to the present leadership of the UAW and President Sean Fain. Hsu notes that in the UFCW, quote, most UFCW members were unaware they were about to get a new president, unquote. The same applies to the UAW election in 2022. Out of 1.1 million eligible voters, only 104,776 cast ballots, while roughly 1 million did not. This turnout of 9% was the lowest turnout of any national union election in U.S. history. The UAW apparatus relied on the Local Union Information System, or LUIS, to provide notice of the election, a system that was historically used only for communication between national and local officials, in an attempt to prevent workers from learning that an election was taking place. According to a survey conducted by rank-and-file socialist candidate Will Lehman, the vast majority of workers never received notice that an election was taking place either via email, phone, workplace poster, or physical mailer. According to an audit of local social media pages, only 7.2% of locals advertised the election on their website, and only 7.7% made any request that members update their addresses to receive a ballot. Only 11.5% of locals made any reference to the election on public local Facebook pages, and only 8.1% made any reference to updating addresses. In the article by Hsu, Jacobin and Labor Notes refer to the fact that two UFCW activists filed a lawsuit in 2024 asserting that the UFCW's election process violates the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. The lawsuit argues that many UFCW locals, quote, provide only the barest reference, often buried in small print in union magazines, not calculated to make members aware that such elections are being held or that they have the right to nominate themselves or others as delegated, unquote. The lawsuit appears significant, but this reference makes it all the more revealing that neither Jacobin nor Labor Notes reported once on the multiple lawsuits brought by Lehman challenging similar disenfranchisement efforts by the UAW bureaucracy, of which Jacobin and Labor Notes form a critical component. Both publications routinely cheerlead Fain in his faction of the UAW bureaucracy, which came to power through the fraudulent 2022 election. Neither publication mentioned the fact that Lehman defeated the Biden administration's Labor Department in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan in 2024. When a federal judge deemed that the department's effort to dismiss Lehman's complaint on timeliness grounds was irrational and arbitrary and capricious, the court ordered the Labor Department to address the merits of Lehman's arguments about massive voter suppression. In the interim months, the Labor Department has simply refused to abide by the court's order. Jacobin and Labor Notes' effort to prop up one bureaucratic apparatus, the UAW, while criticizing another, the UFCW, has led them into an absurd position. The rank-and-file strategy advocated by the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, or IWARFC, is of a totally different character than the bureaucratic infighting of the pseudo-left. In contrast to dead-end efforts to reform the bureaucracy, it is necessary instead to abolish the bureaucracy and transfer power to the rank-and-file workers on the shop floor, both in the UFCW, UAW, and beyond. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.